Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Wednesday, May 7th, 2025. Your readers are Doug Lucas and I am Erica McCarty. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258, and we thank them for their contribution. We will begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 p.m., our featured program will be grocery ads. And now it's time for our TV listings. Doug?
At 8 o'clock on ABC is Celebrity Wheel of Fortune. At 9, Jeopardy Masters, knockouts 3 and 4. And at 10, Jeopardy Quarterfinal, number 2. On CBS at 8 is Survivor until 9:30, and that's Coconut Etiquette. At 9:30 is Amazing Race, Up the River Without a Joust. On Fox at 8 is The Masked Singer, the 2-hour Lucky Season 13 finale. And at 10 is WRAL News on Fox. On NBC at 8 is Chicago Med, The Invisible Hand, followed by Chicago Fire at 9, Cut Me Open, followed by Chicago PD, Black Ice at 10. On ION at 8 is Blue Bloods on Dangerous Ground, followed by Blue Bloods at 9, Heroes. And another episode of Blue Bloods at 10, Poetic Justice. On PBS at 8 is Nature, Hummingbirds of Hollywood, followed by Nova at 9, Ultimate Crash Test, Countdown, followed by Bugs That Rule the World at 10. On WRDC is Dateline at 8, Lauren's Promise, Dateline at 10, Spy Games, followed by Dateline at 10, Twisted Faith. On the CW at 8 is Wild Cards, Sunrise Sunset, followed by Sherlock and Daughter, Partners in Crime at 9, followed by two episodes of the National News Desk at 10 and 10:30. On A&E at 8 is Stadium Lockup, Battle of Ohio, followed by Stadium Lockup, Lost and Loaded at 9, followed by Booked, First Day In, Down in Flames at 10. On AMC at 7 is Gran Torino, followed by Moneyball at 9:30. On BET at 6 is A Thin Line Between Love and Hate, followed by Pain at 9, AS Living at 9:30, followed by Ms. Pat at 10, and another episode of Ms. Pat at 10:30. On Disney at 8 and 8:30 is Big City Greens, followed by Stugo at 9, Kiff at 9:30, Zombies at 10, and Miraculous Ladybug at 10:30. On Discovery at 8 is Expedition Files, Family Secrets, followed by Expedition Files, Identity Crisis at 9, followed by Ghost Adventures, Abandoned at Whiskey Pete's at 10. On ESPN, starting at 7, is NHL Hockey, teams to be announced, followed by a second game at 9:30, again, teams to be announced. On Nickelodeon is Friends, all the way from 8 until 11. On TNT is at 7:30 is NBA Basketball, first round, teams to be announced, followed by another first round at 10, teams to be announced. And lastly, on USA, at 8 is Creed, which takes you up to 10:30, followed by Mission Impossible.
Thank you. All right, our first story is entitled Carney, Canada is Not for Sale. Meanwhile, lawmakers scrutinize border tariffs. President Donald Trump met at the White House with Canada's newly elected Prime Minister Mark Carney on May 6th as lawmakers scrutinized his agenda for tougher border security and tariffs. The two North American leaders started their meeting with glad handing, but also from Carney, with force. Canada, he said, is not for sale. Trump praised Carney on his political comeback, saying Trump, was probably the greatest thing that happened to him. The Liberal Party had been trailing considerably in polls, but won after Carney seized on Trump's rhetoric targeting Canada as the 51st state. Nonetheless, as the meeting began, Carney called Trump a transformational president, pointing to his focus on the economy with a relentless focus on the American worker. Trump suggested in a post on Truth Social ahead of the meeting that he would ask Ottawa to increase its defense spending and close a trading gap with the United States, but would not push a controversial plan to annex the country. On Capitol Hill, members of two House Appropriations subcommittees ostensibly questioned Trump's cabinet secretaries about his spending proposals for the Department of Homeland Security and the Treasury Department. In reality, the two separate hearings went well beyond dollars and cents to criticize or defend the administration's immigration and finance policies. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told lawmakers that the United States is not in a recession. "I believe in data, and there's nothing in the data that shows that we are in a recession," he responded to a question by Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Finance Services and General Government. As a matter of fact, the jobs report has surprised to the upside. The hearing was Bessent's first public appearance on Capitol Hill since Trump implemented sweeping tariffs. Bessent argued to the committee that the administration's policies are already bearing fruit, including adding 464,000 jobs to the U.S. economy. Economic reports released April 30th indicated that the gross domestic product contracted during the first quarter. Bessent said he expects the numbers will be revised after detailed analysis. The secretary has been a prominent defender of Trump's tariffs, though he said privately in April that Trump's 145% tariffs on China aren't sustainable, and the president said he said that he expects to negotiate lower figures. Representative David Joyce, Republican of Pennsylvania, the subcommittee chair, asked what Americans can expect to see on tariffs a year from now. "This will be a path dependent on our trading partners," Bessent responded. Bessent said the administration is negotiating with 17 of the country's 18 largest trading partners, the exception being China. "Those negotiations are proceeding very well," he said, adding that many of those countries have approached the United States with, quote, "very good offers," unquote. "So I expect that we can see a substantial reduction in the tariffs that we are being charged, as well as non-tariff barriers, currency manipulation, and the subsidies of both labor and capital investment," Bessent continued. At the same time, Bessent said the United States is on a warning track for debt default, but he assured subcommittee members the U.S. government will never default and will raise the debt ceiling. "Raising the debt ceiling is included in the massive party line bill Republicans in Congress are working on to implement Trump's agenda. Lawmakers hope to pass it by July 4th. Trump's budget aims to cut the department's funding by 19%, mostly from a nearly $2.5 billion cut to the IRS. Trump has gone through a handful of IRS directors. The budget said the cut would end the weaponization of the agency that allegedly targeted conservative groups and small businesses while protecting taxpayer services. Bessent told the subcommittee that he was aiming to substantially reduce costs. For instance, the IRS spent around $450 million on paper processing last year, he said, through policy changes and automation. The administration aims to reduce that expense to under $20 million. Noam, Trump wants to end FEMA. Trump's abbreviated spending blueprint for the year, started October 1st, aims to cut $163 billion from non-military programs. However, the Department of Homeland Security is one of the places where Trump would bolster spending if Congress agrees, $43.8 billion more on DHS in the next year as part of a $175 billion boost over 4 years. That said, the budget also proposes cutting $644 million in Federal Emergency Management Agency grants. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem told the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security that Trump believes in FEMA as it exists today should be eliminated, and instead wants to provide grants to states to handle disasters. The top Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, asked for evidence of FEMA's alleged failure. Noem said the agency still has claims open from Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Representative John Rutherford, Republican of Florida, said frustration levels are off the chart because FEMA payments lag for years while cities and states pay interest on disaster costs. It's not that FEMA shows up and everything's okay, Rutherford said. It's quite the contrary, actually. DeLauro also criticized a DHS Immigration Enforcement ad campaign as propaganda for Republicans. GOP lawmakers pressed on immigration enforcement of agriculture workers. Representative Dan Newhouse, Republican of Washington, said agricultural interests in his state rely on migrant labor. A major cattle producer in Washington and Idaho has said, voiced concern about Noem's attempt to terminate a program allowing Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans to live and work in the United States temporarily. Newhouse said 15% of the cattle producers' workforce is from those countries. Noem replied that if immigrants who are in the United States unlawfully deport themselves, they could eventually return legally.
Likely papal candidates to succeed Francis span progressive-conservative range. Pope Francis left a legacy as a reformist and a staunch advocate for the marginalized, especially immigrants and the poor. While continuing to fight for underprivileged people may come as a natural endeavor for his successor, the Catholic Church is not known for welcoming change, and Francis faced resistance to his more progressive positions on social issues. Among the key questions in the vote for the next pope will be whether he'll aim to continue Francis' drive toward inclusivity or guide the Church in a conservative direction in matters such as divorced Catholics, LGBTQ plus acceptance, women's roles in the clergy, and the handling of sexual abuse cases. Here's a look at some of the leading names being circulated as candidates to become the new pope in the conclave that began today, with a proviso that favorites don't typically end up getting the nod, leading to the expression, in pope, out cardinal. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, age 67. Tagle is a liberal Filipino with a commitment to social justice that has prompted some to call him the Asian Francis. He prefers to go by his regular nickname, Chito. Tagle has more than 40 years in the priesthood, despite his relative youth, and became the Archbishop of Manila, capital city of Philippines, in 2011. 2 years later, he was regarded as a candidate to replace Pope Benedict, who had made him a cardinal in 2012 before Francis was chosen. Francis provided Tagle the opportunity to gain experience in the Vatican when he transferred him from Manila in 2019 and picked him to lead the church missionary arm. Tagle, who earned a doctorate in theology from the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., is fluent in English and Italian in addition to his native Tagalog. Hailing from a continent where Catholicism has been expanding rapidly could give him an edge. Cardinal Pietro Parolin, 70. There hasn't been an Italian pope since the ultimate death of John Paul I in 1978, which may not seem that long a time until considering Italians occupied the papacy for the 455 years until that point. Parolin, a longtime Vatican diplomat, would represent a return to that tradition, but without embracing a conservative doctrine. He served as Francis' Secretary of State, somewhat like a deputy pope, since 2013, and is regarded as a moderate. Parolin's experience in international affairs includes a stint as the Vatican's ambassador to Venezuela, starting in 2009, and serving as the main architect of the Vatican's rapprochement with China and Vietnam. Cardinal Peter Erdo, 72. A conservative theologian from Hungary, Erdo was also a contender for the post that went to Francis in 2013. But they didn't openly clash despite their different philosophies, and Erdo's pragmatism and alliances in the progressive camp could make him an acceptable compromise candidate. He rose quickly in the church ranks and was named cardinal in 2003 at age 51, making him the youngest member of the College of Cardinals until 2010. A two-time president of the Council of Bishops, Conference of Europe, Erdo is considered a leader in the church's drive to revive the Catholic faith in advanced secular countries. Erdo is close with the government of Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban. That and his conservative credentials amid a conclave dominated by cardinal electors chosen by Francis could present a big hurdle for Erdo's path toward the papacy. Cardinal Peter Turkson, 76. A native of Ghana who has long pushed for social justice, Turkson could become the first African pope in more than 1,500 years at a time when the Catholic Church has made a big strides in that continent. Turkson, now a Vatican official, was named a cardinal by Pope John Paul II in 2003 at age 55 and appointed to lead the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace by Benedict 6 years later. His credentials on issues of poverty and climate change are likely to appeal to France's allies, but Turkson leans on conservative on other matters such as homosexuality and contraception. I believe it would be very natural to choose someone from Africa, Asia, or in any case from those parts of the world where the church is, in some way, more alive, more dynamic, and with more of a future, Swedish Cardinal Anders Arborelius told the Corriere della Sera newspaper. Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, 69. A favorite of Francis, who named him cardinal in 2019, Zuppi has shown a similar inclination toward humility, mingling with the people, standing up for the poor, and opening to doors the LGBTQ community. As the Archbishop of Bologna for nearly 10 years, Zuppi has been known on occasions to eschew an official car for a bicycle while traversing the city streets. Father Matteo, as he prefers to be called, has also traveled to meet high-profile world leaders like former President Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Considering the Italian media has referred to him as the Italian Bergoglio, Zuppi may struggle getting support from conservatives. His main black mark among progressives has been the slow response to the sexual abuse scandal from the Italian Catholic Church, which he has led since 2022. Cardinal Joseph Tobin, 72. Could the next pope be from New Jersey? Tobin, a progressive and Archbishop of Newark, is among the 10 Americans who will have a vote in the conclave. He's also among those papal watchers believe may have a chance to be elected pope. The National Catholic Reporter noted that 72 years old background is impressive and largely built outside the United States, a fact that might set at ease any concerns about a pope from a global superpower. Tobin was close to Francis, whom he met in 2005, and who elevated him to cardinal in 2016. A Detroit native and one-time auto mechanic, Tobin is a member of the Redemptorists, an order known for its work with the poor, immigrants, and the spiritually abandoned. He rose through the ranks before leading the order. Tobin, the National Catholic Reporter noted, was among Francis' staunchest supporters among American bishops, a man whose affable style and easy humor helped with friends even among ideological opponents. He's frequently in Rome, so he has a familiarity with how the Vatican works and has been known to use the city's public transit system to get around. Cardinal Jean-Marc Aveline, 66. A native of Algeria, Aveline has been described as France's favorite bishop, according to the Catholic Herald. He comes from a family of refugees who settled in the French port city of Marseille in 1965. Aveline would eventually become archbishop of that city. A favorite of progressives who bears some physical resemblance to another papal reformer, John the 24th, he's also a pragmatist who understands how cities can struggle to feed, house, and assimilate refugees and immigrants, and has won the respect of some of France's traditional Catholics for his efforts to protect their interests. His work in Marseille, a city that's a microcosm of many of the world's challenges, including migration, climate change, income inequity, and interfaith clashes, may help bolster his chance for leading the church through a host of secular problems. Cardinal Angelo Scola, 83. The Archbishop Emeritus of Milan, a city near the village where he was born, Scola is too old at 83 to have a vote in the papal conclave. Still, he's seen as one of the contenders for pope. Elevated to the role of bishop by John Paul II, Scola founded the Oasis International Foundation, which fosters dialogue and understanding between Christians and Muslims, focusing on Christian minorities living in Muslim countries. He was among the favorites to succeed Benedict when he resigned in 2013, and he's long been known as a writer and a scholar whose work was highlighted by Francis in a piece published posthumously in Vatican News. Cardinal Mario Grech, 68. Grech is a native of Malta who's currently Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops, a role that's put him in the center of the ongoing and controversial Synod of Synodality, which would shape the future direction of the Catholic Church. Supporters believe the 68-year-old has helped lead the charge toward a more inclusive and interactive approach to church governance, while others say he's undermining the hierarchy of the church and its leaders. He's announced in March a new phase in the synod process that would bring bishops, clergy, religious, and lay people together to propose ideas for the church's future, instead of the traditional synod of bishops. Once known as a social conservative, Grech and his views have evolved through the years, and he's defended France's inclusion of LGBTQ plus people and support for immigrants and refugees in Europe. Cardinal Juan José Amela, 79. The Archbishop of Barcelona, Amela believes lay people can play a larger role in the church Eucharistic and liturgical observance, and has been an outspoken critic of Spain's efforts to reform its abortion laws. He's also drawn fire for his response to reports of sexual abuse by Spain's Catholic clergy, accusing Spanish media of trying to mislead the public about the scope of the scandal, even while asking for forgiveness for those who've been impacted. Seen as affable and unpretentious, Amela lives humbly in the same way Francis did, promoting social justice and advocating for a more compassionate and inclusive church. He worked for 16 years with Spain's Manos Unidas, which battles famine, disease, and poverty in developing nations. And last but not least, this is my vote, just because of this cardinal's name, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa. I'm sorry, I added the Italian, that's me. He aged 60. Pizzaballa's worldview has been influenced by his upbringing in rural parts of northern Italy. The 60-year-old Patriarch of Jerusalem enjoyed a simple country life where the local priest would visit on a bicycle, and where Pizzaballa decided early in life that he wanted to become a priest as well. He arrived in Jerusalem as a young priest in 1990 in the midst of one of the region's many fierce conflicts. He studied at Hebrew University and was able to absorb non-Christian points of view and learn the Hebrew language. He earned a reputation as a trusted emissary among the Christian, Muslim, and Jewish communities in the Holy Land during his many years there, and he is the first cardinal to reside in Israel. In the wake of the October 7, 2023 attacks by Hamas and the subsequent Israeli assault on Gaza, Peter Bella called for prayer and even offered himself as a hostage in exchange for the release of children held hostage by Hamas. He's continued to call for peace, condemning Hamas's terror campaign as well as the civilian death toll in Gaza. His pastoral positions, though, are not well known, and he's rarely spoken out on some of the church's hot-button issues. He's known as someone to open the modern world while still maintaining church orthodoxy and tradition.
That was a tough one. Soviet-era Cosmos 482 is in final death plunge to Earth. A Soviet-era spacecraft is set to re-enter Earth's atmosphere after over 50 years, returning this week from its failed mission to Venus. NASA said on May 5th that Cosmos 482 will return on May 5th, that Cosmos... NASA said on May 5th that Cosmos 482 will return to Earth sometime between May 7 and May 13. The spacecraft is most likely to begin its descent on May 10th, though. The space agency said that since the probe was designed to withstand entry into Venus's atmosphere, parts of it may survive re-entry. The spacecraft was meant to be a Venus probe, but it failed to escape low Earth orbit following its launch in 1972, according to NASA. Jonathan McDowell, an astronomer at the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard and Smithsonian, told NPR that the probe is in its final death plunge. There's a not trivial chance that it could hit somewhere where it damaged property, and there's a small chance, but it's like one in thousands, that it could hurt someone, he said. The name Cosmos was given to Soviet spacecraft that remained in Earth's orbit beginning in 1962, regardless of whether that was their intended final destination, according to NASA. The space agency points to evidence from Soviet and non-Soviet sources and historical documents to substantiate its belief that Cosmos 482 was intended to reach Venus. The probe was launched 4 days after the Venera 8 atmospheric probe that made it to Venus and had an identical design, NASA said. Soviet planetary missions were initially put into Earth's orbit as a launch platform with a rocket engine and attached probe, according to NASA. The probes were then launched toward their targets with an engine burn with a duration of roughly 4 minutes. Cosmos 482 separated into four pieces, with two pieces decaying in low Earth orbit within 48 hours, and the remaining pieces remaining in higher orbit. It is thought that a malfunction during the engine burn left the craft unable to reach the velocity needed to escape orbit and reach Venus, according to NASA.
Now for the announcements. Our work is threatened. Can we count on you to... And you, so our community can continue to count on us? Did you know this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Protection and Advocacy Network? As North Carolina's designated PNA, Disability Rights North Carolina, or DRNC, has proudly carried out our federally mandated mission, protecting and advocating for the rights of people with disabilities across our state. Funding cuts threaten the service and protections we provide to individuals with disabilities and those who love and care for them. This isn't just a budget line thing. This is about real people losing access to education, health care, safe housing, and the support they need to live with dignity and independence. We are proud of what we've accomplished, but we cannot continue this work without your support. We urge you to act now to protect the rights and safety of disabled North Carolinians. Together, we've built something powerful over the last 50 years. Let's make it sure it lasts another 50 and beyond. To find out how you can help, go to disabilitiesrightsnc.org/takeaction. And there are local plays in the area with audio descriptions. And on Saturday, May 10th, in Greensboro, is Back to the Future at 2 o'clock. And Sunday, May 11th, again, is Back to the Future at 1 at the Tanger Center, which is at 300 North Elm Street in Greensboro. Tactile tours are available at North Carolina Museum of Art. These tours are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. These docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are available by request only. You must arrange them at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please contact Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncmuseum.org or call 919-664-6854. Have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on a AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell the note's denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at www.bep.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it in to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit www.bep.gov or call toll-free 844-815-9388. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our program on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assisted technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say tune in NC Reading Service to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following the initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
All right. We have an opinion piece today written by Ashley McGuire. She is a senior fellow with the Catholic Association. She is co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Conversations with Consequences. And her opinion is entitled, A Woman Won't Be Pope. That's fine by me. I can predict only one thing with certainty about the next pope. He will be 100% biologically male. That fact, and that he will be chosen by an all-male college of cardinals, which convenes May 7th, to lead a global institution that refuses to compromise on its teaching concerning an all-male priesthood, which will strike many as antiquated and even offensive. Today, the prevailing view among cultural elites has rendered them unable, or more likely unwilling, to define what a woman is, even in the most basic biological sense. And while our contemporary Western culture struggles to delineate women, in the year 2025, the Church has been fine-tuning its teachings on her as complement to man, while fully his equal since Anno Domini, A.D., year one. Catholic Church's teaching on women is countercultural. The Christian approach to women has been radically countercultural since the beginning. The longest recorded conversation Jesus has in the Bible is with a woman of ill repute. He chose a woman to deliver the news of his resurrection and the message of salvation to disciples. And most significantly, he chose a woman from whose flesh to take his own divine body and then made her queen of heaven and earth. This in a culture where women had little to no rights and were widely viewed as categorically inferior to men. More than 2,000 years later, the Church's teachings on women remain radically countercultural. The Church stands boldly athwart of a post-Christian culture where women are commodified, objectified, and exploited through promiscuity and prostitution, sex trafficking, artificial reproductive technology, and toxic reproductive pharmaceuticals, abortion, and surrogacy. Further, the Church has been unflinching in its opposition to gender ideology, the logical ends of which erase women as a category and at great cost to our basic legal standing and foundational human rights. But because the Catholic Church does not ordain women as priests, according to social elite label makers, it must be sexist. In the 15 years since I entered the Church after reading a series of Catholic thinkers on human sexuality, I have yet to meet a single Catholic woman of any political stripe, socioeconomic, professional, or marital status, or age, who has expressed frustration over the fact that priesthood is all male. We love our priests. We do not want to be them. The Catholic women I know, and I meet weekly in a church basement with a diverse group of them, are grappling with the same struggles as other women, such as the pain of infertility, marital conflict, addiction, and the challenge of forming happy families in a culture defined by radical individualism. To us, the Church is a source of community and boundless consolation. Being a Catholic woman is not about power, but about love, self-sacrifice, and friendship. These were the deeper hallmarks of Christ's ministries, and they define authentically Christian life. Pope John Paul II addressed women's mission of service. Being a Christian, as it turns out, is not about power and influence, but about conquering those distorted aims in service to others, a mission women live out particularly well in our feminine genius, as Pope St. John Paul II liked to call it. Through the insight, which is so much a part of your womanhood, you enrich the world's understanding and help to make human relations more honest and authentic, he wrote in his 1995 Letter to Women. And so you will forgive us for refusing to cede any ground on the rights and dignity of women to a culture that cannot bring itself to define women and hold up the likes of pornographic actress Bonnie Blue, whose wealth is built on setting sexual records and who is often associated with so-called women's empowerment. Instead, you will find us holding fast to faith that continues 2 centuries later, to promote the different but equal roles of men and women in living out Christian virtue. These different but mutually cooperative roles reflect God's desire for our cooperation with Him. And understanding those differences rather than trying to stamp them out is essential to authentically elevating the role, particularly of women, in the Church and in the world. Defending this uniquely Christian principle now falls to the next successor of St. Peter. Roman Catholic women in the world over will soon look to him to courageously carry out the most important task.
This is Opinion Pages, written by USA columnist Chris Brennan, and can be found on X, formerly known as Twitter, and is entitled "Economy Failing, So Trump Distracts Us with Picture as Pope." The cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church will meet in a conclave on May 7th at the Vatican to elect a successor to Pope Francis, who died on April 21st at the age of 88. It's supposed to be a solemn time for reflection on the legacy of the papacy and the future of the Church. But for President Donald Trump, it's an opportunity not to be the next pope, but to distract you from the developing damage he has brought to the United States economy. That's the clear motivation for Trump's latest attempt to troll America, posting on his social media platform, Truth Social, about 10:30 p.m. on May 2nd, what appears to be an artificial intelligence rendering of Trump as Pope with the traditional white vestments, white and gold mitre, and a large gold crucifix around his neck. That offended plenty of people, including Catholic Church officials, and that was the point. It's easy to be distracted by Trump's social media antics, which are now past the point of poor taste and have lapsed into the range of blasphemy. That's what he wants. Here's the trick to decoding Trump's distraction tactics. Look and listen for the conversation he doesn't want you to tune in on. If Trump is trying to distract you, determine what it is that he wants you to look away from. This time, it was easy to find. NBC News, just an hour before Trump tried to troll us with his Pope picture, had started to release on social media video clips and details about his interview on Meet the Press that was airing on May 4th. One slice of that, Trump telling moderator Kristen Welker that he would be okay if America went into a recession in the short term, was startling to go viral as the social media commentators expressed outrage at his nonchalance. Remember here that Trump, who was a shady businessman with a history of bankruptcies before NBC's The Apprentice, irony alert, rewrote his narrative to be an economic genius in the absurdly genre of reality TV, now sees every day of his life as an episode in a television show where he is either winning or losing. Shrugging off a recession was a bad look. Trump knew it and needed a plot twist. If he couldn't win the day, maybe he could distract us from how he was losing. A picture as Pope, posted for his 9.7 million followers on Truth Social, would get that done. But to really change the subject, Trump was going to need a boost. The White House's official account on X, with about 1.7 million followers, reposted the president's Pope picture nearly 40 minutes after he put it up. That's the thing about Trump's trolling absurdities. They always need amplification. Attention is the fuel for distraction. That's where the outrage comes in handy. The Catholic bishops of New York State took umbrage at Trump's Pope picture, posting this response on X. There is nothing clever or funny about this image, Mr. President. We just buried our beloved Pope Francis, and the cardinals are about to enter a solemn conclave to elect a new successor of St. Peter. Do not mock us. Their displeasure is understandable, but understand also that it plays into Trump's need to distract. This might be a good point to note that Trump, while campaigning in 2024 for re-election, accused then-President Joe Biden of persecuting Catholics. Try to imagine Biden, a devout Catholic, posting a picture of himself as Pope to distract from a negative news cycle. He'd never go there. But Trump, who isn't Catholic, has always been a skilled salesman. The Associated Press in November found that the president increased his votes from Catholics from 2020 to 2024. But that was last year. That election is over. If mocking Catholics is useful now, then why not? Trump clearly thinks it is. Trump's Republican Party these days breaks down into three camps for his displays of tactical stupidity on social media. The MAGA base cheers for outrage, his deferential congressional allies stay silent, and true conservatives in America shake their heads at what the GOP has become. The next time that Trump trolls, look at what he's afraid of. This isn't new. The journal Nature Communications is in a report published a week after Trump lost the 2020 presidential election to Biden, noted that Trump had used social media posts to distract Americans and shift focus for the media, including when there was news about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. We find that increased media coverage of the Mueller investigation is immediately followed by Trump tweeting increasingly about unrelated issues, the authors of that study wrote. This increased activity, in turn, is followed by a reduction in coverage of the Mueller investigation, a finding that is consistent with the hypotheses that President Trump's tweets may also successfully divert the media from topics that he considers threatening, the report said. Keep that in mind the next time Trump tries to distract you with outrageous antics. Don't just lean into the fury. Step back and look for the larger context. Ask yourself what exactly the president needs you to look away from. Then study the topic he wants Americans to ignore. Learn what Trump fears so much that he needs a stupid stunt to make you look away.
Now moving on to our money section, our cover story is Economists. Fed is likely to say it's no in no rush to reduce rates. If you're hoping a first quarter contraction of the nation's economy will spur the Federal Reserve this week to hint that it could soon resume its market-friendly interest rate cuts, you may want to curb your enthusiasm. Economists expect federal officials to hold rates steady after a two-day meeting May 7th and repeat that they're in no hurry to lower rates. They're likely to say they'll wait for further clarity as they struggle to navigate the effects of President Donald Trump's tariffs on their two key missions, keeping inflation low and employment high. While U.S. gross domestic product technically shrank in the first 3 months of the year, the economy fundamentally remains sturdy. On the other hand, inflation is still moderately above the Fed's 2% goal, with Trump's import duties set to propel prices higher. Why does the Fed increase interest rates? Normally, a vibrant economy and job market push up inflation, prompting the Fed to raise its key rate or keep it higher for longer to cool activity. A slowing economy or recession typically constrains price increases and causes the central bank to cut rates to stimulate growth and hiring or dig the nation out of a downturn. But Trump's sweeping tariffs are expected to sharply raise consumer prices and thus curtail household spending, presenting a worst-of-all-world scenario known as stagflation. That would leave the Fed torn between its two mandates. Consumption makes up 70% of economic activity and powers job growth. In that event, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said the Fed would assess which goal, stable prices or maximum employment, is furthest away and prioritize achieving it. On May 7th, Powell will probably mention, quote, that if the Fed dual objective comes into conflict, it will likely adopt a balanced approach, end quote, Barclay wrote in a research note. But Powell also suggested last month that all things equal, the Fed's obligation is to keep longer-term inflation expectations anchored to make certain that a one-time increase in the price level from tariffs does not become an ongoing inflation problem. In a note to clients, Morgan Stanley wrote, "We expect the Fed to lean in on direction of emphasizing price stability." Added Deutsche Bank, "We think the message will continue to be that the labor market will need to show signs of weakening before the Fed contemplates any further reductions in the policy rate." In other words, the Fed does not intend to deliver preemptive rate cuts as President Trump had recently called for. Will the Fed cut rates again? Fed future markets figure the Fed will start cutting rates again in July and approve 3/4-point cuts by the end of the year. Other forecasters have grown warier. Barclays pushed its estimate of the first rate cut from June to July and expects just one more decrease in September. Morgan Stanley predicts no rate cuts until 2026 unless the economy tips into recession this year, as many forecasters expect. The Fed slashed rates by a percentage point late in 2024 after a pandemic-related inflation spike eased, but has paused since as the import levies threatened to reignite price hikes. Here's why Fed officials could signal that they're inclined to wait longer to reduce rates. To be sure, the economy shrank at the annual rate of 0.3% in the first quarter, but that's because of goods imports swelled an eye-popping 50% annualized as companies raced to order foreign merchandise before tariffs kicked in. Imports are subtracted from U.S. GDP because they're produced in other countries. Goldman Sachs expects that effect to reverse in second quarter, boosting growth. Meanwhile, consumer spending increased a solid 1.8% and business investment leaped 22.5%, underscoring the economy's pillars are still strong. Final sales to domestic purchasers, which excludes trade and inventories, grew a healthy 2.3%, Morgan Stanley noted. Some of the consumer and business purchases were also aimed at getting ahead of tariffs, economists noted. Still, the demand from households and companies were there. Meanwhile, U.S. employers added a robust 177,000 jobs in April and average 155,000 the past 3 months. Unemployment sits at an historically low 4.2%. The Fed is likely to look through some of the noise in the quarterly GDP data brought on by trade policy uncertainty, Morgan Stanley said. Inflation is still elevated. Inflation also softened in March. The Fed's preferred overall inflation measure dipped from 2.5% to 2.3%, and a key reading that strips out volatile food and energy items fell from 2.8 to 2.6. That's encouraging, but it means inflation is still well above the Fed's 2% target. The Fed's attention will be on inflation, as it remains the furthest from its objective, Oxford economists said in a research note. Also, forecasters expect tariffs to drive inflation much higher by mid-year. Given the tariffs now in place, we expect inflation to pick up significantly in coming months, Barclays wrote to clients. The research firm estimates core inflation will peak at 3.8% in 2025. Consumer and business confidence surveys may send misleading signals. Although consumer and business confidence have tumbled amid the flurry of Trump's tariff announcements and the resulting stock market sell-off, sentiment also fell dramatically when the Fed hiked interest rates sharply in 2022 and 23. But that didn't lead to a recession, casting doubt on the value of the polls, economists say. Fed officials will want to see evidence from labor market and other hard data before delivering rate cuts, Goldman Sachs said. Inflation is likely to spike before the economy weakens. John Williams, head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and a voting member of the Fed's policymaking committee, said he expects inflation to rise to 3.5% to 4% this year. Then he expects unemployment to climb to 4.5% over the next year, according to the Morgan Stanley. It will be hard for the Fed to cut rates to head off a potential labor market slump if inflation is rising first, is further from its target than employment is, Morgan Stanley said. Immigration crackdown may keep unemployment from rising swiftly. Trump's deportations of hundreds of thousands of immigrants who lack permanent legal status this year are likely to slow growth in the labor supply. Fewer people looking for jobs means the unemployment rate could rise more gradually even as hiring slows and layoffs spread, making it harder for the feds to cut rates, especially with inflation heating up, Morgan Stanley said. Some say the Fed could reduce rates earlier. Goldman Sachs, however, says the Fed could move sooner and more forcefully to reduce rates. Intensifying business uncertainty could lead to the less hiring, more layoffs, and the first signs of weakness in the May employment report, Goldman said. Meanwhile, businesses' worries should lead to fewer job openings and less capital spending within a couple of months. Goldman thinks the Fed will start cutting rates in July and lower rates three times this year.
Spring break ends. Florida town police chief says tumult is out of hand. Florida's Bay County locals are reacting to the spring break comments of Panama City Beach Police Chief J.R. Telemantes. In an April 13th Facebook post, Telemantes says Panama City Beach can no longer be a spring break town. That time is over. Every year, we try to manage it and every year it brings more challenges, Telemantas wrote in the Post. I'm not willing to risk the safety of our city to hold on to something that no longer works. Let me be clear, our law enforcement officers should not be expected to shoulder the burden of an event that no longer aligns with the values or vision of this community, Telemantas added. It's unfair to continue placing that weight on the backs of the men and women who serve and protect this city every day. Roy Denton, a Bay County local, said, I think it's a good idea for our town to become a non-spring break destination because these shootings are getting ridiculous. There was a reference to shootings in the Panama City Beach Pier Park area on March 29th and April 3rd. During an April 4th news conference, Sheriff Tommy Ford made comments on behalf of the entire Bay County community. Our community is tired of this, Ford said. This is not the place to do this. This community has been through a lot in the relation to the crimes you see before you today. Do not come down here with the intent to do criminal activity. Panama City Beach is known for its beautiful beaches, condos, and attractions. Various local businesses thrive due to the city's status as a dominant spring break destination. I think that Panama City Beach not being a spring break town would hurt local businesses, said April Bell, also a Bay County local. I'm a condo owner myself, so I think that those of us who own short-term rentals would be severely affected by the Panama City Beach not being a spring break town. I don't think that discouraging spring break tourism is a good idea for various regions, said Hajil Mitro-Smith, another Bay City local. First, someone who works in the hospitality industry would be greatly affected. Second, I make a lot of trips around this time, and we, as a local community, work in a very seasonal place. Third, if this town is a hot tourist destination, what's the point of not having tourists during the busiest time of the year? The News Herald reached out to Mayor Stuart Tedemer for his take on the matter. I'm fully committed to making Panama City Beach as safe as it can be for the people who live here and for those who visit, Tedemer said. I support our law enforcement and am working with those who care about keeping the beach safe and strong. I don't understand how Panama City Beach not being a spring break town would work, said Austin Minshew, a Bay County local. As a local, I kind of see it from both perspectives. If you're local, there would be less traffic and our beaches would not be so chaotic. Our town would be safer. As a business owner myself, a lot of small businesses are not going to be around if Panama City Beach is not a small spring break town, Minshew added. A lot of these businesses are the reason why Panama City Beach is so well known. We would lose a lot of money. Ford expressed some other thoughts on Facebook. Spring break still draws some visitors with bad intentions, folks bringing guns, starting fights, or disturbing our community, Ford wrote. We're committed to deterring this behavior and ensuring everyone feels secure. In the coming weeks, we'll need open discussion and honest debate with residents, business owners, and community leaders to sharpen our strategies. To those who choose to bring harm, know this. We are vigilant, united, and unwavering, Ford said. Our deputies and officers will always stand ready to protect this community we love.
And it's time for some sports stories. We've got cover story Commanders Harris making people forget Snyder. Chalk up another big win for the Washington Commanders, who have come a mighty long way in a very short time since what's-his-name buried the dignity of that used-to-be-called franchise so deep into the mud. Last week, the Commanders and Native Son owner Josh Harris announced a deal to bring the franchise home from the Maryland suburbs in 2030. Pending D.C. City Council approval with a $3.7 billion stadium project on the hallowed grounds of RFK Stadium. On May 5th came official word that the NFL draft hosted by the Commanders is coming in 2027 to the National Mall. Lights, cameras, monuments, and Mel Kiper Jr. Let the congressional record show no way this gets done with Dan Snyder. Yet here's what was always possible. Once the NFL was able to separate itself from the widely reviled Snyder in 2023 for the record sale tag of $6.05 billion, the NFL again has a signature franchise in the nation's capital. Long-suffering fans wearing hog noses and memories of the fun bunch are back on the bandwagon, ushering in a new generation. Politicos on Capitol Hill, even in these perilous times, might have reason again to come across the aisle for the sake of football. Snyder swung and missed in seeking stadium deals in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. It has taken less than 2 years for Harris to strike the stadium deal and deliver the draft the NFL has long envisioned for D.C. Apparently, entities that couldn't or wouldn't do business with the franchise when it was owned by Snyder are now more willing and able. They've brought honor back to the franchise sports, consultant Mark Gaines told USA Today Sports as news of the draft announcement spread. That's what changed the entire political landscape. It's the perception of the franchise. It was always vitally important to the community, but no one wanted to go near it politically, especially for many years. And shoot, the Commanders' product on the field has blown up too, with 2024 Rookie of the Year Jaden Daniels leading the way to the NFC title game in January. What significant markers for the comeback of one of the league's oldest franchises? Take it from President Donald Trump, the red-hot Commanders are... Wait a minute, take it from who? That it was Trump who made the announcement about the draft at the White House with Harris, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, and Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser in the wings was quite the play on political football. The draft, Trump trumpeted, is a big thing. And like I'd suspect for many D.C. residents, hey now, that Canada isn't in the mix anyone for being the 51st state? Trump is bullish on the idea of the 65,000-seat domed stadium. I don't think there's a better site than anywhere in the world than that site, Trump declared. Please, given the pending process, just don't try to make it an executive order. Be not deceived by the optics. While it is undoubtedly beneficial to have the president supporting the NFL's biggest off-season tentpole event, the D.C. draft has been the league's vision for years. He does not get credit for this. Trump hopped on a train that was already moving toward the end zone. Then again, it's hardly surprising that Trump, who in February became the first sitting president to attend a Super Bowl, seized on a prime opportunity. A week earlier, Trump, after golfing with Saquon Barkley, hosted the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles for a ceremony, even though Super Bowl MVP Jalen Hurts and more than a dozen players didn't show up. And now he's on the clock for the draft. This, after spending time in recent days with Nick Saban, as speculation persists that he will take aim at the name, image, and likeness, NIL, impact on college sports. Yet big announcements like we saw May 5th or a week ago, when Trump lobbied to keep the tush push while feeding champs, also provide some cover of distraction for matters that I'd suspect matter more to many Americans. You know, the economy, tariffs, and the threat of recession. Democracy, respect for the Constitution and judicial system. Political targeting, due process for deportations, and so on. The Q&A part of the NFL event got underway. Football took a backseat to questions about illegal immigration, Alcatraz, a potential trade deal with China, and so on. Watching from home, I flashed back to the Trump from his first administration when he viciously attacked the NFL, and particularly its players, as the national anthem protests inspired by Colin Kaepernick over the killings of unarmed minorities by police gained momentum as part of a larger cultural movement. What's the reaction from Trump and the NFL if there are more protests ahead? Already, Trump has made it clear what he thinks of one of the NFL's core social principles, diversity, equity, and inclusion, while attacking it on a broad systematic scale. The NFL, to its credit, has held firm with its DEI commitment against the grain of so many companies rolling back what they once said they stood for. The NFL still has the Rooney Rule and an accelerator program and will collaborate with the Black College Football Hall of Fame next month for the Ozzie Newsome General Manager Forum and a quarterback coaching summit. Then again, the politics flowed both ways as Goodell, who often defends the NFL's DEI efforts with vigor, showered Trump with gratitude for his support on the stadium deal. "Great to come back home," said Goodell, who, like Harris, grew up in the district. His deceased father, Charles, represented New York as a U.S. senator and congressman and left a legacy for his moral standing as a prominent anti-Vietnam War advocate. Yet Goodell was clearly on a political business mission at the White House. It seemed a bit odd at first that he thanked Trump for the North American trade agreement and struck during the president's first term. Then when Trump replied that the money earned by the NFL was well deserved, the pact allowed local TV ads to be shown in Canada during the Super Bowl, increasing the value of the league's Canadian broadcasting rights. The politics were crystal clear. Harris knows. A pivotal factor for progressing on the stadium deal came in December when Congress, despite apparent resistance from Maryland lawmakers, with the team currently playing in their state, transferred jurisdiction of the RFK Stadium site from the federal government to the District of Columbia. Gaines doubts this happens without the ownership change. Snyder was that toxic. "Nobody ever touches it," Gaines said. "He doesn't get the legislation for the conveyance of the property. The deal with the city doesn't happen. Roger, as hard as he's worked on this for years and as much influence as he has had, could not get anything through. It's a new day, like a dream for D.C.'s football faithful." It's no wonder Harris took a moment at the White House to reflect on that theme. "I grew up here," he said. "D.C. used to stop on Sundays. Everyone would be inside watching football or glued at the stadium. So we want to bring that back. That vision for the Commander's Chief is fueled these days by so much momentum."
Nugget's never give up attitude pays off. Chaos has enveloped the NBA playoffs, striking the top seeds in stunning fashion. The second-seeded Houston Rockets were eliminated in the first round. The top-seeded Cleveland Cavaliers lost Game 1 of their Eastern Conference semifinal series against the Indiana Pacers. And the second-seeded Boston Celtics lost Game 1 of their Eastern semifinal series to the New York Knicks. Late in the day, May 5th, the fourth-seeded Denver Nuggets, behind a massive offensive performance from All-Star center Nikola Jokic, defeated the top-seeded Oklahoma City Thunder 121-19 in Game 1 of their Western Conference semifinal series. The Nuggets finished the game on a 19-16 run, capped by Aaron Gordon's game-winning three-pointer with 3.6 seconds left. Game 2 is Wednesday in Oklahoma City. The Nuggets' three-time MVP Nikola Jokic, who is again a finalist for the award, had 42 points and 22 rebounds and 6 assists. He scored 18 points in the fourth quarter and was 15 for 29 from the field and 10 for 13 on free throws. It was the fifth time he has scored at least 40 points in a playoff game and the first time he has had a 40-20 playoff game. If he plays like that for the entire series, and he has proven he can, the Nuggets, who won the title 2 seasons ago, have a shot at returning to the conference finals. Jamal Murray had 21 points, 6 rebounds, and 6 assists. Gordon generated 22 points and 14 rebounds. Christian Braun delivered 11 points and 13 rebounds, and Russell Westbrook had 18 points. MVPs aren't decided in the playoffs. Votes were due before the playoffs began. However, Oklahoma City guard Shai Gilgeous-Alexander once again showed why he's a finalist for the award. He had 33 points, 12 for 26 shooting, 10 rebounds, and 8 assists. Gordon had a game-winning dunk at the buzzer in Denver's Game 4 victory against the Los Angeles Clippers, and added a game-winning 3 in Game 1 against Oklahoma City. Caruso the Thunder reserve, had 20 points, 6 assists, 5 steals, and 2 blocks. And Oklahoma City outscored Denver by 13 points in Caruso's 26 minutes on the court. He was 7 for 12 from the field, including 5 for 9 on 3-pointers. There's a reason the Thunder acquired Caruso in the offseason from Chicago for Josh Giddey, and the Thunder signed him to a 4-year, $81 million extension in December. With the Thunder leading 117-114 late in the fourth quarter, they played the foul game in the attempt to prevent Denver from trying to score with a 3-pointer. The Thunder fouled Jokic with 12.9 seconds left and Gordon with 12.7 seconds left. They made all four free throws, and with Oklahoma City ahead 119-118, Thunder big man Chet Holmgren missed 2 free throws with 9.5 seconds remaining, setting up Gordon's game winner. Ultimately, the decision extended the game and allowed Denver to stay within the possession of taking the lead. Thunder coach Mark Dijsselt, I don't think that's right, defended the strategy, saying it's worked for Oklahoma previously. Early in the second quarter, Denver and Oklahoma City were a combined 3 for 23 on 3-pointers, and Denver ended up 2 for 15 on 3s in the first half. Both teams found more success from that range in the second half, but were still a combined 25 for 75 on 3s. Having swept Memphis and not played since April 25th, the Thunder faced a rest versus rust question. Well, the Thunder showed rust, especially down the stretch of a game in which they led by 11 points with 4.31 seconds left. That's 4 minutes 31 seconds left. 2 days after playing in a Game 7, four Nuggets players logged at least 39 minutes, including game-high 44 minutes by Murray and 42 minutes by Jokic. We will see how the minutes weigh on Denver throughout the series, but to win this game showed the Nuggets are more than ready for the challenge.
And we have time for one more short little sports story. This is called Brick by Brick, 12 Stats from the Celtics L. This is sort of becoming the New York Knicks thing. For the fourth time this NBA postseason, the Knicks erased a fourth quarter deficit to pull out a victory. This time it came on the road in game one of their second round series against the Boston Celtics in a 108-105 overtime victory. The Celtics struggled throughout the night, May 5th, with their shooting, but those issues came far more pronounced in the second half when Boston bricked shot after shot. The Knicks, on the other hand, scooped rebounds and tried to push the ball up through the court to create uncontested looks. 12 wild stats that fueled New York's 20-point comeback victory at TD Garden in Boston. From 5:45 in the third quarter until 7:26 in the fourth, the Knicks went on an extended 31-11 run to wipe out 20-point Boston lead and tie the score at 86. The Celtics shot 15 of 60, 25%, from three-point range. The 60 attempted threes and 45 misses were single-game NBA playoff records. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown combined to shoot 5 of 25, or 20%, from beyond the arc. During New York's lengthy 31-11 run, the Celtics hit just 3 of 15 attempted threes. The Knicks, meanwhile, drained 5 of 9, 55.6%, from 3 over that span. In the fourth quarter, Boston shot 2 of 15 from beyond the arc. In the fourth quarter, Tatum scored 2 points, both of which came on free throws. He missed all 7 of his field goal shot attempts, 5 of which were 3-point tries. In the second half, OG Anunoby and Jalen Brunson combined to go 13 of 21 from the field, including 8 of 10, which is 80%, from 30 over that span. As a team, the Knicks laced 11 of 19 three-pointers in the second half. In the second half, Anunoby and the Brunson combined for 40 points. Tatum and Brown combined for 14. Tatum played 9 minutes and 26 seconds in the fourth quarter. In the period, his player impact estimate, PIE, statistic used to measure a player's overall contribution was -9.4. By comparison, his PIE for the 2024-25 regular season was 15.8. The Celtics shot 35% from the floor, 25% from three, missing 45 attempts from beyond the arc. Were outscored by 16 in the second half and lost the game by 3 points.
From the Life Session, Met Gala is back in black. Superfine theme brings out stars of color and their tailored excellence. It's fashion's biggest night at the Met Gala. The annual event returned to the Metropolitan Museum of Art on May 5th, the first Monday in May. This year's Met Ball is an invite-only event overflowing with A-list talent, celebrated the museum's Costume Institute and its spring exhibit, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style. The exhibit and the night's dress code, Tailored for You, highlighted black dandyism, and the midnight blue carpet was overflowing with black excellence all night. With celebrity attendees including AAP Rocky, Spike Lee, Janelle Monáe, Usher, and more, the famed steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art were full of immaculate suiting, custom couture, and inventive takes on tailoring. A focus on black history and personal style was inherent in each ensemble, from Diana Ross's feathered 18-foot train to Rihanna's reveal of her baby bump. USA Today had an exclusive spot on the red carpet, so follow along for all the top moments from that night. As previously mentioned, Rihanna arrives to debut her baby bump. Rihanna arrived to cheers and camera flashes at 10 p.m., close to an hour after the last attendees headed inside the event. Though Mindy Kaling, Angel Reese, and Megan Thee Stallion jetted out before her arrival, Rihanna's entrance was not to be missed. She came with an important plus one. Her just-announced pregnancy was on full display. Rihanna accentuated her baby bump with a voluminous pinstripe gown and a massive hat on top of her cascading braid. A cropped suit jacket, detached collar, and padded jacket attached at her waist was set off by a polka dots in the form of an ascot and pocket square. The wait, as usual for a fashionably late star, was absolutely worth it. She smelled sumptuous as she walked by, celebrating her Marc Jacobs look and her co-chairman, A$AP Rocky. After co-hosting for hours, Treanna Taylor knows that her Met look is looking, but it's not the same as when she first arrived on the carpet. "I took off my jacket. My back hurt, babe. I've been standing up in that outfit all day. I'm just trying to get up in there, get the food, get to the bathroom. I've been holding my pee for the last 3 hours. I can relate," she said. "Life is great," she added with a smile. "Life is great." Diggs found his Met Gala look on Pinterest. NFL star Stephon Diggs told USA Today about his Bianca Saunders look, a black suit with a light brown and cream fur coat on top. "We collaborated on a look. Black designer, very proud moment, trying to give her flowers. She's done some great things," he said. As for his inspiration for the look, "I actually was on Pinterest and was trying to find what works and saw a little bit of James Brown with tailoring of this suit, and then I went with some Teddy Pendergrass with the fur." The football player, known for his signature love of a cropped top, made sure his suit jacket was cropped. Diggs, who started his own fashion brand, Liam, knows the ups and downs in fashion. "It's still a lot of research and development. It's a lot of money going out. You have to take your lumps, and it's a learning curve," he said of his fashion line. Lizzo goes blonde, makes a TikTok. Lizzo grabbed her phone at the top of the steps, pulling over to the side to film a TikTok video. "I'm making a TikTok, shh," she said as she recorded a video of the moment. Pharrell is as cool as ever. Pharrell, one of the event co-chairs, arrived as cool as ever in a pearl-encrusted suit jacket and sunglasses with his wife rocking LV tights in support of her designer husband. His jacket had 15,000 pearls and took 400 hours to create. Diana Ross makes quite the entrance. Diana Ross knows how to make a grand entrance. In an 18-foot-long train, the enduring diva stunned in a white feathered cape over a bejeweled gown. She was flanked by her son, Evan Ross, who helped her adjust her oversized feathered hat. Debbie Allen channels black elegance. Debbie Allen also told USA Today on the blue carpet that she was channeling a night of elegance and blackness and cultural identity. When asked her ideal black dandy, she didn't miss a beat and quickly said, "Norman Nixon," looking at her husband of more than four decades. "You're looking at him." Gigi Hadid is a vision in gold. Gigi Hadid, fresh off celebrating her 30th birthday and making her relationship with Bradley Cooper Instagram official, was gilded in gold with an old Hollywood updo. Her gold gown was custom Miu Miu and celebrated icon Josephine Baker. F1 driver Lewis Hamilton in all white. Lewis Hamilton breezed to the top of the Met steps almost as quickly as he drives his race cars in a cream-colored tuxedo and matching bow tie and hat adorned with a golden brooch. Domingo was an embodiment of dandy fashion. Coleman Domingo arrived in a cape and later revealed a perfectly tailored suit underneath. Domingo rounded out the early arrivals of the co-chairs in an expertly tailored, glittering black and silver suit jacket. The actor followed up the look with a more understated but equally fabulous ensemble featuring a pearl-embroidered blazer, polka-dotted handkerchief tie, and a floral brooch. Lala Anthony, one of the Vogue livestream hosts, was in archival off-white by the late Virgil Abloh. Wintour arrives at the Met red carpet. Black Men's Choir Silk and Sounds officially opened the carpet with a beautiful performance of Ain't No Mountains High Enough. The choir wore tailcoats and sounded silky smooth, of course. Anna Wintour arrived shortly after in a pale blue coat atop a silk white gown with her signature blonde bob. Emma Chamberlain stuns in a backless dress. Emma Chamberlain might just break the internet with her dapper frock. The social media personality stunts on the red carpet in a sleek pinstripe dress that mirrors the crisp tailoring of a menswear suit. The dress's halter collar and flowing train put a refreshing feminine twist on the black dandy theme. Met Gala theme was black dandyism. The theme coincides with the Metropolitan Museum of Art Costume Institute spring exhibit, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, which the Institute describes as a cultural and historical examination of black style over 300 years through the concept of dandyism.
Diddy trial, judge bans language of abuse. There's no shortage of discussion over the impending New York trial of rapper Sean Diddy Combs. One phrase you won't hear during the legal process, coercive control. Combs was arrested in September in Manhattan and charged with racketeering, sex trafficking, and transportation to engage in prostitution. He has pleaded not guilty. Jury selection begins on May 5th. As the trial looms, federal prosecutors and Combs' legal team have clashed over what expert witnesses testimony the jury will be allowed to hear. Judge Arun Subramanian ruled that psychologist Don Hughes is not allowed to discuss, quote, coercive control, end quote, which is a type of domestic abuse. She is, however, allowed to discuss coping strategies for victims and why many victims stay in abusive or violent relationships. The ruling is significant in this case as prosecutors will bring alleged victims of Diddy to testify about abuse, and defense attorneys will try to dispute their statements. Accusers' past communications with Diddy, previous statements about him, and anything and everything they've previously said about the allegations are likely to be scrutinized. People can lose their perspective when they are under the thumb of an abusive person, says psychologist Lisa Fontes, author of Invisible Chains, and a frequent expert witness in cases related to sexual violence and coercive control. Mr. Combs's wealth and fame gave him an extraordinary amount of power. He is certainly not the first man alleged to have used that power sexually to exploit others. What is coercive control? Coercive control is a term popularized by sociologist Evan Stark, and who theorized that the way abusers take other victims' lives is similar to the psychological torture and control used on prisoners of war and cult members. Domestic abuse cases are often discussed in the context of physical and or sexual violence, but coercive control tactics could include those as well as many others, such as isolation, intimidation, micromanagement, monitoring, financial, verbal litigation abuse, Fontin says. The issue with the way domestic violence is discussed, trauma experts say, is that victims are almost never taken seriously unless they have proof of being physically harmed. Coercive control is verbal, psychological, and much more difficult to prove in a court of law. People don't understand that these psychological tactics are extremely harmful to the brain, says Christine Cocciola, a social worker and advocate who specializes in cases of coercive control and narcissistic abuse. The brain actually becomes trauma bonded to these abusers and sadly is not able to really clearly discern between what's healthy and unhealthy. You could take a really healthy person and all of a sudden they're engaged in a really harmful relationship. Why can't coercive control be discussed? Subramanian has not publicly explained why coercive control cannot be discussed during the trial, but legal experts say it's likely has to do with the fact that only 7 states in the U.S. have laws about coercive control. California, Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Wisconsin. But New York, where Combs is charged, does not. Coercive control is a newer term in the legal world and is only considered a form of domestic abuse in those 7 states. And even in those states, Cocciola notes, it's still very hard to prove. When it comes to the Diddy case, there's a chance the prosecution could motion for permission to use the terms as the trial continues. John Meyer, a clinical law professor and director of George Washington University's Law School Violence Center. She believes it's possible to talk around it at the trial and still make an impact. If the expert is allowed to testify about why victims don't leave or stay connected, that's mostly attributable to coercive control. So I trust they will get it in that way, Meyer speculates. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Doug Lucas and Erica McCarty have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 a.m. for readings from the News and Observer. Up next is our featured program, Grocery Ads.